Hi, this is Carolyn Sloan from the Maine Humanities Council, and I'd like to welcome you to another in our series of podcasts exploring the power and pleasure of ideas.
Now, let's turn to some slightly longer conversations abridged from half-hour television interviews during the spring of 2006. Mike Paternitti and Sarah Corbett, husband and wife, live and write in Portland, but they usually find their material for magazines and books in far-flung places around the globe. I started the conversation with Paternitti, who had written a very unusual travelogue called Driving Mr. Albert.
The idea for the book, the original germ of the idea, was a story that was told to me during a commercial break in the first Gulf War. It was a roommate of mine named Miles who told me this sort of urban legend that Einstein's brain had been stolen when he died and had been passed around and ended up in a garage in Saskatchewan. So with that little seed of an idea, I just kept repeating this story to people. We were living in New Mexico, and our landlord was somebody who I told the story to, and he started correcting the story as I told it, and then told me that the man who had stolen the brain was actually the pathologist who had done the autopsy, and this man lived next to William Burroughs in Lawrence, Kansas. And our landlord happened to be very close to William Burroughs, so he was the one who put me in touch with the pathologist. Completely random.
That's called the journalism god smiling on a young writer, right? So you did it.
Yeah.
You did it. Now, maybe you could just read a passage that gets us into it a little bit and set us up for that so people have a flavor of what this is about. You and the pathologist decide to go to California. And why Einstein's brain is in the back is that the pathologist has gotten a little guilty about keeping it all these years and feels it should be returned to the family, right?
Right.
Anything else you need to set up?
Well, at that time, he was 86, and he had had the brain for 30 years, or 40 years, I'm sorry. And he, I think, realized that he was nearing the end of his life, feeling all this guilt for having, under very cloudy circumstances, taken the brain, and he did. He wanted to give it back. So I think this is from a moment when I'm with Thomas Harvey, the pathologist, and we're just driving around in Princeton before we go on the road trip.
Okay.
On a cold winter day, during one of my early visits to Dr. Harvey, we drove around Princeton, making the obligatory pilgrimage to 112 Mercer Street, the house where Einstein spent the last 20 years of his life. We sat for a while, with the car running, warm air pouring from the heater, gazing at a modest wood frame colonial with black shutters on a pleasant block of like houses. More than anything, Einstein said he loved the old place for the light that filled the upstairs rooms and for the gardens out back. He kept pictures of Michelangelo and Schopenhauer hanging in his study because, as he said, both men had escaped an everyday life of raw monotony and taken refuge in a world crowded with images of our own creation.
What year did that come out?
That ran as a Harper's article in, I think, 97.
Yeah.
And we went on the trip in 96. And then it turned into a book and came out as a book in 2000.
So Sarah Corbett, while all this was going on, you were following a women's basketball team? Was that somewhere about the same time?
Yeah, it was about the same time. I think I was actually writing my book on the women's basketball team when Mike took the trip.
Yeah.
Originally.
Yep.
Oh, which is why occasionally he gets lonely. He even mentions that, I think, in the book. But what were you up to? What women's basketball team? What was going on there?
I spent most of the year, the end of 1995 and 1996, traveling with the U.S. women's basketball team. This was a big march up to the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, and there was a lot of excitement at that time about that particular Olympic team because it was sort of an all-star team, and for the first time they had the funding to have this year-long roadshow leading up to the Olympics, which was really a test market to see whether this country was ready to support a women's version of the NBA.
Yeah. Now, why did you choose that? Just because you thought it was a moment in women's sports history?
Yes, it was funny. It was not something I had. To be honest, I had never even seen a full basketball game before I was sent as a magazine writer to go visit this team. And I thought, oh, I'll spend 2 days and that's it, and I'll learn a little and I'll leave it behind me. And the first time I went, I met this team in Northern California, and they said, oh, come to one of the practices. And I thought, oh, this is great. I'll be me and the women on the team, and I'll have all this intimate access. And I showed up for this practice, and there were something like 400 young girls there, and they were going crazy. They were screaming in the stands. They knew all the players' names, and I sat there. You know, at that time I was in my mid-20s, so I wasn't that much older than these young women, but that had never been any part of my experience growing up as an active person, to feel what it meant to be a part of a team and to look at team sports and have idols. And so something in my mind, my writer's mind, clicked on and said, oh, I need to stay with this. And I was lucky enough to get a book contract, and boy, did I see a lot of basketball that year.
I like the way you use the phrase, the writer's mind. And obviously, in both of these cases, writing is an avenue to some part of a world that you would never get to otherwise. You've done a lot more like that since. For example, I remember a New York Times Magazine article about the Lost Boys from Sudan. But you don't go to Sudan, you go to Midwestern America. Mm-hmm. You also wrote a really moving piece about soldiers returning from Iraq. I wonder if you could just read a little bit of the start of that. It's called Coming Home.
Sure.
And it too appeared in the New York Times, I believe.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. This story is, this was from the winter of 2004. And so this was, what I did was I went to an army base in Kentucky where some of the first soldiers to come out of Iraq injured were coming. And they actually had a support group, and they would help each other through this time. And it was really interesting for me because this was the first wave. You know, here we are a couple of years into it, and there are now thousands and thousands of soldiers. And I feel like I learned a lot very early on. So this is the beginning of a story, which is about a soldier named Robert Schrode. Robert Schrode can't sleep. At night, in the fly-specked town of Guthrie, Kentucky, in the rented farmhouse he shares with his 20-year-old wife, Deborah, he surfs the internet, roams the house. He lies down and gets up again. He drinks a beer and stares out the window at the black fields beyond. Hours pass. He can't sleep. Before the war, he could have 6 beers and sleep like a baby, but now that works against him. Drinking may help get his head to the pillow, but it also ratchets up the nightmares. For a while, he sweated out his bad dreams on the living room couch, and it drove Deborah crazy. She would come down from the bedroom, touch his shoulder, ask what the problem was. Schrode would just turn his back to her and not say a word. Now she knows better than to ask, though occasionally, when the silence between them gets too deep, she'll put it out there. What are you thinking about? Iraq, he'll say, and then the silence falls again.
It's so amazing that we, because you bring us right in at the very beginning into the most intimate possible moment in these couples' lives, and we don't question, well, how did she get there? She got her head on the pillow? Is she in the between these two people? Did that understanding of their relationship come late in the process, and you sort of knew enough to put it at the beginning of the piece? I mean, how do you get into these people's lives that I would imagine might be a little reluctant to let you in?
Yes, and in particular, I think of all the stories I've done, that view of that couple, and Robert Schrode, who is sort of my major character through it, he did something really brave, which is open himself up during a really vulnerable time in his life. And it took a long time, though. I was flying from Portland to Kentucky. This support group met every other week, and so I just kept going out for their meetings. I was grateful that they let me in, because that in itself was very private, and I would just fly there and spend a few days. And maybe on my second or third visit, Robert, I had asked if I could meet his wife, and he said yes, and she came, and he had told me she was very shy, and she didn't say a word for the first half hour, and he talked and talked, and I was sort of thought to myself, oh, this is too painful, I can't write about her, it's, you know, she's 20 years old. And they left, and I thanked her, and about 10 minutes later, they came back to this office I was sitting in, and he said, Deborah wants to talk to you alone. And he left the room. And then she just started talking and talking and told me a lot of really intimate things and understood I had a tape recorder there and also before at the New York Times Magazine, before anything is published at any magazine virtually, a fact checker will call and review those details so that nobody's shocked that, you know, oh, I told her that, but I didn't understand that would be published. And, you know, I think that being that first wave of soldiers and soldiers' wives who were going through something that was very dramatic and life-altering for both of them, I think somehow they understood that it was important to share it and that it there was value in that for other people.
This podcast was brought to you by the Maine Humanities Council with support from the National Endowment for the Humanities and friends like you. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.